This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Senator Chris Murphy spoke last week about a proposed ban on the use of U.S. ground forces inside Iraq and Syria. It's part of an ongoing campaign that Murphy's been waging in Washington to rethink foreign policy. He co-authored an opinion piece last week for Foreign Affairs that maps out an eight-part plan to reshape how America deals with the world. He's also not been shy to talk about trans-Pacific trade and weigh in on the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, something many U.S. politicians have avoided. The Huffington Post called him part of a new guard on international policy, taking over for retired figures like former Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman. Today, Where We Live, taking a look at the globe with Senator Chris Murphy. We welcome your calls and questions, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Chris Murphy joins us today from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to the program, Senator. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'd like to ask first about this opinion piece that you wrote for Foreign Affairs with Senators Brian Schatz and Martin Heinrich. This piece essentially lays out a new type of foreign policy. I'd like to tackle this point by point, if you would, but first tell us why you think it was important to do this now.
So I was elected to Congress in 2006, and one of the primary motivations for running was my opposition to the Iraq War, the way in which it was being conducted. And there's a whole generation of leaders here in the Senate and the House whose foreign policy viewpoints are really formed by one war we should have never entered into, the Iraq War, and another that was badly mismanaged, the war in Afghanistan. Now, that doesn't mean that those of us that opposed those wars or the way in which those wars were conducted are isolationists, that we don't want the United States to play a role in the world. In fact, for me, it's the very opposite. I think the United States is still the one indispensable nation in the world. And at a time when the world is more chaotic, when there are more civil conflicts, more refugees, growing levels of famine and need all across the world, we can't back away from our responsibility. But we want to learn the lessons from the past. And that's what this effort is all about. What is a new way for the United States to lead in the world, recognizing that the blunt force of military power, especially utilized in the Middle East, seems to do more harm than good? How are we allocating resources between our military toolkit and our non-kinetic toolkit? And is that properly balanced today? What are the things that we can do here at home that speak to our ability to lead abroad? Isn't there a connection between practicing what we are preaching in other places? So my real worry was that coming after the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts, that there were going to be a lot of voters out there who were just going to say, let's pack it up. There's a lot of problems here at home. Let's just focus on rebuilding America, not recognizing that there was a different way that we can exert influence in the world that looks different than what we have seen over the last 15 years. That's what this effort is really all about.
Mm. One thing that we should note is this piece written with two U.S. senators, both from the Democratic Party. I'm wondering what we can read into that, Senator Chris Murphy. Often when leading senators get involved in major either foreign or domestic policy issues, they try to court someone from the other side and forge some sort of an alliance so that people say this is indeed bipartisan. But these are three Democratic senators essentially saying we need to rethink things. What should we read into that?
Well, it's no secret that, you know, I've been able to find some really strong partners on the Republican side for particular initiatives. For instance, you know, John McCain and I have stood side by side on most of the work that we've done to support Ukraine. And in fact, John came to Connecticut to talk to the Ukrainian community with me a few months ago. So when we've been advocating more military support for the Ukrainian army or more financial support for the Ukrainian government, I've been doing that in a bipartisan manner. But the reality is that there was this dispute playing out within the Republican Party between the John McCain interventionalists and the Rand Paul isolationists. It looks as if the neoconservatives, the interventionalists, have won that debate. And you just look at who's advising the Republican presidential candidates, it's essentially the architects of the Iraq War, who are pretty unapologetic about the mess that they got America into. And with Obama having only a year and a half left on his presidency, I want to make sure that if the John McCain-Lindsey Graham wing of the Republican Party is now going to be dominant, that there is a counterbalance on the progressive side in the Democratic Party, whereby we can say, listen, the only answer to the problems that this country faces is not invading people, that there is a different way to go. I trust that Obama generally gets that, but he's only president for another year and a half. So on specific initiatives, I'm going to continue to reach out and find Republican support. But I did think it was important for Democrats and for progressives to articulate something that was a counterbalance to what we're seeing as the newly dominant theme, renewed interventionalism within the Republican Party.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you can talk through some of the nuance of that, because obviously John McCain, Lindsey Graham, who says he's running for president, Joe Lieberman, who stepped away from the Senate, were all seen to be in alignment with this common theme that if there's a way that the United States can get involved in a foreign conflict, they should. And if there's a way that the U.S. can arm those overseas in order to help our interests, we should. Essentially, your eight-part plan rejects an awful lot of that, but you're able to find common ground with John McCain on Russia and Ukraine. I'm wondering if you can talk through the nuance of a relationship like that one with McCain, who clearly is on the other side of the fence with you on so many foreign policy issues.
So I think Ukraine is a perfect example of a place where I think we have gone through the sequencing in the right way. First and foremost, it's important to make sure that Ukraine is stable economically. There's no pathway moving forward for Ukraine if they're collapsing internally because of a weak economy. So John and I got together and said, listen, let's put together a billion-dollar support package from the United States Congress that will help stabilize the economy. That was the first thing we did. Second, let's use our diplomatic power and our economic power to try to isolate Russia. So we pushed the administration to join with Europe to enact a fairly crippling round of sanctions on the Russians to try to change their behavior. It was only when our economic support for Ukraine and our economic sanctions against Russia didn't work that John and I came back to the table and said, okay, we need to look at the next steps. And the next steps are not the United States military getting involved in this conflict, but limited military support for the Ukrainian army. And so that's what we proposed, but only after we had taken a series of non-military steps to try to solve the problem. And both of us have drawn a fairly hard red line when it comes to whether or not American troops are going to get into that fight. Now, I don't doubt that at some point John McCain or Lindsey Graham may propose putting American troops on the ground in Eastern Europe, but that's not what we're proposing today. So I think Ukraine is an example of where we've exercised American power at the proper scale. Support for a friend, economic sanctions against an adversary, and then limited military support without putting U.S. combat troops on the ground. That's very different than what some of my friends, John McCain, Lindsey Graham, et cetera, are proposing in the Middle East. Their proposals there look much more like the kind of mistakes we made 10 to 15 years ago.
We're talking with Chris Murphy, U.S. Senator from Connecticut, who joins us from Washington today. We're talking through new ideas in foreign policy. He wrote an opinion piece with Senators Brian Schatz and Martin Heinrich for Foreign Affairs. We're going to be walking through this piece if you are interested in what Chris Murphy had to say to maybe follow along with our conversation today. Just check us out on Twitter at Where We Live. We've tweeted out links to the story. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Starting at the top of what you've put forward in this plan, you suggest first that our military spending shouldn't be 10 times what our foreign aid budget is. You suggest a new Marshall Plan for at-risk regions. What would this look like?
Well, here's another way to think about it. So, yes, our military budget is 10 times that of our foreign aid budget. But here's another example of how out of whack our spending is today. We have actually more lawyers in the Department of Defense than we have diplomats at the Department of State. Now, America should be the biggest, baddest, most capable military in the world. And so while I can certainly find places to trim in the military budget, I'm not arguing, nor are the other authors of this piece arguing for a massive downsizing of the American military. I actually think that at an incredibly turbulent time, it's right that we continue to be able to have capabilities that no other countries have. What we're arguing for is for our foreign aid budget to catch up. Back when we actually did put into place the Marshall Plan in the wake of World War II, we were spending in 1950 about 3% of the nation's GDP on foreign aid, rebuilding friends and enemies, a pretty extraordinary thing to do. And it got us allies that have lasted the entirety of the post-World War II era because we were so generous and because we built up stable democracies and stable economies. Today, we're spending 0.1% of our GDP on foreign aid, a 94% reduction from the 1950s and 1960s. And we're getting what we pay for. The Middle East, Eastern Europe, parts of Africa are slipping into chaos because they have absolutely no answer for the economic dislocation of their citizens who find their only square meal, their only paycheck coming from groups like ISIS or Boko Haram or Al-Qaeda. I'm not saying that the United States should cure global poverty, but if we have some intensive focuses on trying to help rebuild the economies in places like Lebanon, in places like Iraq, in places on the Russia sphere, that's a pretty worthwhile investment. So I don't think we need to get to a point where our foreign aid budget looks like what it did during the 1950s or the 1960s. But if we're spending some more money in targeted places to try to compete with ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab for recruits, then that's going to keep us a lot safer than any investment in Tomahawk missiles on the back end will.
One question, of course, people always have about foreign aid is, who does the foreign aid go to, and how do we know that it's reaching the people it needs, that it's not being filtered through some resistance movement that may seem like they're going to be an honest broker at first that will then turn their back on their people and turn their back on the United States?
So I think it's important to be honest and recognize that when you're spending a lot of money on foreign aid, that there's going to be some places in which it doesn't go right. When we spent money again in the wake of World War II, we sent it to governments that we wanted to support, and we let them make some broad decisions about where it should go. A lot of what we do with foreign aid today is bypass domestic governments, and we send it directly to nonprofits who are going to or to different service providers who are going to address specific issues on the ground. That's important, but it may be more important actually to build the legitimacy of local governments, assuming that they're doing the right thing and not doing as Nouri al-Maliki did in Baghdad, simply taking that money and spending it just on the Shia populations instead of sending it to Sunni areas as well. So I think you're going to just have to accept that there's going to be some inefficiencies in that system. But again, comparing it to military spending, there are enormous inefficiencies in the military budget as well. It's still the only budget of the U.S. government that can't get a clean audit. When we fire missiles, some of them hit their targets, some of them don't. And we accept that as a risk of doing business on the military side. We're going to have to accept some risk on the non-military side, understanding that if we are lifting thousands more people out of poverty in at-risk regions, that is thousands less people who are going to join the fight against us.
Let's go to the phones. And Liz wants to ask a question from New Britain. Hi there, Liz. You're on with Senator Chris Murphy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Senator Murphy. I'm a huge supporter, and I admire you greatly. But thank you for all the great work you're doing for Connecticut and our nation. My question is this. Given your comments about your approach to the Ukraine and going at it with economic sanctions and then military support rather than troops on the ground right away, how do you see that differing from what we've already tried when in the past, such as our support to Afghanistan when they were battling the Russians, the Soviet Union, and supporting the rebels there the way we did without boots on the ground and with just military aid, and look at who we were supporting at the end of the day?
Well, I think there's a really important distinction between the two. We know a lot about what happened in Afghanistan in retrospect, but almost all of that support for the Mujahideen was happening covertly. It was happening without any oversight from the United States Congress, save for Charlie Wilson and a handful of people on the Defense Appropriations Committee. That's not what I'm advocating for. And it went wrong. It went wrong in part because no one was watching where those weapons went. Nobody was vetting who we were actually giving them to. And in the end, as we know, the story goes, we were training Osama bin Laden and a band of Islamists who eventually formed the core of al-Qaeda. I think there is a very different thing playing out in Ukraine. This is not a resistance. This is an established government, an established military. In Afghanistan, we were secretly funding a separate resistance movement that was different than the Afghan government. In Ukraine, we're funding a very well-known entity, the Ukrainian military. And by the way, McCain and I are advocating for this, but the president hasn't decided to do it yet. And secondly, we're not advocating to do it covertly. And as we will maybe get to as part of our principles, one of the things that we're advocating for as part of this new way forward on foreign policy is to get out of the business of the CIA being essentially a parallel military to the United States Army and the U.S. Navy and Marines and Air Force. We are going to support the Ukrainians, hopefully militarily, but let's do it openly. Let's have a debate in Congress about what levels of support. Let's vet who the funding and the weapons are going to. And my argument is if you do it that way, you're going to end up in a very different place than if you do it the way we did it in Afghanistan, which was essentially letting the CIA get away with some really dangerous activities, funding and arming some very dangerous people outside of the purview of the United States Congress and the sight of the American people.
We are going to be talking through these principles that are mapped out in a piece for Foreign Affairs, co-written by Senator Chris Murphy. He joins us today from Washington. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. You can send us an email, wherelive@wnpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking with Senator Chris Murphy, who has co-penned a piece for Foreign Affairs laying out new principles for how we should deal with the rest of the world, a new type of foreign policy. We're taking your questions at 860-275-7266. I'm going to take a call from Ben here, who's going to jump us ahead perhaps in our principles to near the end of your eight list. But I want to get to this because it's very important. Ben, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I read the document that Murphy and the other legislators put out, and I think it's great, especially recognizing that climate change is a threat to foreign affairs and our world in general. So I wondered if the senator could explain why he would support gas pipelines coming into Connecticut and Massachusetts from Pennsylvania when we know that methane is a huge contributor to climate change, and we know that we have the renewable energy to not need the gas coming into Connecticut.
Ben, thank you very much for your question. So we're jumping ahead to the eighth principle, talking about climate change, but a very specific domestic question out of Ben.
Well, I actually think that that's a really good question to frame here, because you can talk about climate change in the broad sense and why it's important, but if you want to do something about it, you actually have to change the way in which you make individual domestic policies. So, you know, there are a lot of reasons why we decided to make climate change a very specific part of our plan for a new way forward on foreign policy. If you look at the story of how a place like Syria fell apart, much of it comes back to the fact that the climate already has changed and that there are parts of the world today where droughts happen for much longer periods of time. They're much more intense and much more devastating. And the story of the resistance movement in Syria, as well as the story of the resistance movement in places like Mali, are connected to record periods of drought in which farmers simply could not survive any longer. They either started going hungry hungry themselves or started flocking to cities, creating more urban instability. Climate change is not a future threat. It's already a present threat because of what the kind of economic dislocation that it's causing around the world. But Ben is right. If you're serious about that, you have to make different choices at home. And the reason that the United States is starting to lead when it comes to our overall carbon emissions is partially because of gas, partially because though gas is not as clean as solar or wind, it is cleaner. It has less emissions than coal or oil does. And so Senator Susan Collins and I, a Republican from Maine, have gotten together on this very specific question that Ben brings up. How do you continue to transmit gas to places like Connecticut where we need it? I mean, we still run our economy largely on gas, and so we can't forsake it completely while controlling the methane leakage. That's an example of a bipartisan bill that I've worked on that actually will reduce overall emissions while allowing us to bring gas into the state of Connecticut, which is going to be part of our energy mix, whether we like it or not, for the next 10 to 20 years. But it's really important for all of our decisions domestically to be framed in this international conversation about climate change. I think on the question of gas transmission, you can recognize the need for more transmission while cracking down on things like methane emissions, and that will allow us to lead in the world in the way that I'm hoping.
I think the one thing that Ben and many others who are hoping for an increased push in the United States toward renewables, a thing that they might look at is, well, look, earlier you said that each dollar that we spend on a lawyer at the DOD is a dollar that's not spent on a diplomat at the State Department. It's essentially us making choices around foreign policy. In that same way, each dollar we spend to increase our natural gas pipeline capacity is a dollar we're not spending on developing new renewables. And for many people, they say that's the politics of today as opposed to, you know, the politics of tomorrow, looking ahead to where we want to be in 10, 15 or 20 years.
Yeah, and I don't want to back down from how generally revolutionary I am on this subject. I mean, I support an overall cap on carbon emissions. I would support some form of a carbon tax if the money was used to go back into renewables. So, you know, I think that, you know, I am as out front as you can be right now on trying to find new sources of funding for renewables. I just recognize that it doesn't happen overnight. There is always a balance between how badly you want a renewable economy and how fast that you can get it. It's partially why you know, I oppose the Keystone Pipeline, which was a truly dirty source of energy, tar sands oil, coming into the United States with a much bigger global warming potential than the gas coming out of a pipeline from Pennsylvania to Connecticut. But no, we absolutely have to change our energy mix. And of course, we have over the last 5 to 10 years, which has altered our foreign policy already. We are admittedly less reliant on a country like Saudi Arabia. We don't have to respond to their beck and call because we are only a few years away from not needing to import Middle Eastern oil to the United States because not only of the increase in renewables, but because of the development of our own natural resources. So this is part and parcel of an overall strategy to make the United States less dependent on places like the Middle East, allow us to have a little bit more balanced footprint in the world. But it doesn't happen overnight. It happens with some pace.
We're talking through some principles on foreign policy laid out by Senator Chris Murphy. We've tackled numbers 1 and 8. Let's go through some of the rest. And one of the things you write is America is strongest when it works through international organizations and broad multilateral coalitions. How best to form these coalitions, the ones that are perhaps temporary, and how much do we want to be involved more in the long-standing coalitions, ones like the UN and NATO?
So I don't think either of those are mutually exclusive. I think that our prejudice should be working through the United Nations and organizations like NATO. But if we can't get consensus in those organizations, it shouldn't stop us from acting, in part because the United Nations right now, the way it's structured, allows for countries like Russia and China to have veto power. But if we can't get consensus in organizations like that, we should try to build as broad a coalition as possible. And if none of our friends are willing to support us in a particular endeavor, particularly a military endeavor, then it should cause us to question whether we were right in the first place and think about the consequences of splitting alliances. So I'll come back to Ukraine. I have called, again, along with people like John McCain, for the United States providing some more levels of lethal military assistance to the Ukrainian army. Right now, the Europeans generally don't support us on that. And I have cautioned the president to move forward on this only when he gets significant buy-in from the Europeans, because what is worse than the Ukrainians not having the exact level of military hardware that they need is for the United States and Europe to be split on the question of supporting Ukraine and causing consequences to accrue against Russia. That's actually what Russia wants to do here. They want to break the transatlantic alliance. They actually care more about that than they do about breaking Ukraine. And so I think that that's an important example of where you need to work through body of your partners. And if your partners won't support you, if the United States is the only country that would be willing to arm the Ukrainian military, then it should certainly cause us to wonder whether that's the right strategy in the first place.
We read this weekend, though, about the U.S. moving military equipment back into Eastern Europe in a deal with NATO countries. Of course, NATO, an international organization, but honestly, the might of NATO is really in the might of the U.S. military. When you see something like this, the U.S. Housing more arms in Eastern Europe for the first time in many, many years. What do you see there? How does it play into the principles that you're laying out?
Well, you know, international organizations can't be in name only, and that's right now what NATO risks being. The United States at the outset said we would contribute 50% of the costs of NATO and our NATO partners would pick up the other 50. Today, that number is more like 70% U.S. contribution, which is unacceptable. And so, you know, we're arguing that the United States should reinvest in these international institutions, that we are just simply stronger when we have partners, that there's no weakness in the United Nations and NATO. But admittedly, that argument is only useful if our partners are actually stepping up to the plate as well. And in NATO, that is not happening. In the UN, frankly, it's the United States often that is a laggard in terms of putting in our fair share. But this has got to be a project of mutual concern and mutual investment for it to work. And some of that is outside of the United States' control.
Whether it's arming Ukraine or moving some of its military weaponry into Eastern Europe, do you think that we risk a very strong reaction from Russia, given that the leader of Russia, Vladimir Putin, seems so, in many ways, unhinged from the reality that the rest of us live in?
So I think when we look at Iraq and the mistake that we made there, we simply didn't understand the ramifications outside of Iraq, that once you destabilize that country, put American boots on the ground, you are going to make it the cause celeb for the terrorist movement all over the world. You are going to anger lots of our friends in the region, countries like Turkey. You are going to empower countries that previously had been relatively dormant, like Iran. And so I think you've always got to think, when you're talking about a specific military intervention, the broader ramifications of acting or not acting. And here's where Ukraine comes into play. This is the really first example of an unchecked invasion of a country by another country in the post-World War II environment. And there are other countries that are watching, China at the top of the list. China right now is pushing in its influence throughout the seas that surround it, the East China Sea and the South China Sea primarily, starting to contest claims for islands with the Japanese or the Philippines. And if they think that the rules of the road have changed, that you can just invade a country's territory and largely get away with it with no consequences, then they are going to start really disrupting the balance of power in and around Asia. And so in this case, I argue that the ramifications of not acting are global, and that if Russia isn't paying a price, then countries like China are going to start to act out as well. And so sometimes we misunderstand the consequences of acting militarily in a particular region, as we did in Iraq. Here, I think that we are misunderstanding the consequences of not acting because of the exceptional nature of what Russia has done in Crimea and eastern Ukraine.
You write in these principles that when military action is needed, we need clear goals, clear exit strategies, and we always need congressional approval. There's a lot of parts in there. The important one off the bat is getting congressional approval for anything, certainly something as controversial as military intervention, seems almost impossible right now in the Washington in which you inhabit. So talk about this. It's very important to have these exit strategies and a plan and congressional approval. Maybe very, very hard to get right now.
So the way in which the president is conducting foreign policy today has the effect of facilitating congressional dysfunction. So when the president says that he can fight ISIS without congressional authorization, in this case, he cites the 9/11 authorization of military force, which was passed in the wake of the attacks in New York and Pennsylvania, as his authority to go after ISIS, a group that specifically disavows an association with al-Qaeda, the named enemy in that authorization. He lets the Congress take a pass. I mean, Congress doesn't have to step up to the plate and pass a war authorization because the president says, I'm going to do it with or without you, which is what he said. He said, I don't need Congress's authority. I want it, but I don't need it. And so I would argue for the president being more judicious in the way in which he conducts military power overseas. If there is no congressional authorization, then force the Congress to pass it. One of the lessons I think we learned over the course of, again, going back to Iraq and Afghanistan, is that we were a nation divided over that war. And I think it's very dangerous to go into major military conflicts overseas in which we're putting American lives and trillions of American dollars on the line when we are badly divided. It's even worse when the American public doesn't have any say, because when it goes wrong, then they can just throw up their hands and say we weren't responsible. So I argued from the beginning that the president should not have gone forward with this campaign against ISIS without congressional action. And I think he's largely allowed for Congress to sit back and do nothing because he has never claimed he needed that authority in the first place.
Another part of this principle, though, is that we need clear goals and clear exit strategies. This is something that we've long heard, a dispute between civilian and military leaders, really on both sides of this issue, about whether or not announcing when and how we're going to exit a conflict may or may not embolden or lengthen a campaign. How do we address that particular issue?
Well, I think what I'm saying is don't go in to a conflict unless you know what your exit strategy is. And then as you move down to the next bullet point, unless you understand that the nature of these conflicts today are really political at the foundation rather than military. You know, it used to be that armies marched against each other. And when one army was defeated, a peace treaty was signed and life got back to normal. That's not how it works today. ISIS arose not in a military vacuum, but because of a political vacuum, because all of these Sunni tribes were being treated so terribly by the government out of Baghdad that they aligned themselves with what is essentially a death cult that they didn't have an ideological connection with, but they had an economic grievance that could be exercised through ISIS. And so what I'm saying here is that don't go into these conflicts unless you understand how you are going to address the underlying political and economic weaknesses that give rise to the instability in the first place. And you know, that's why I think it's so crazy to propose sending troops, American troops, back into Iraq. Yes, if we put 100,000 troops into Iraq for whatever time that our troops are there, we will probably keep ISIS at bay. But we will make the situation worse in the long run, not better, because our occupation will once again create recruitment material for the enemy that we're battling. And we likely won't do anything about the underlying problems that Sunnis are facing with a Shiite government in Baghdad. And so I just think that there are a lot of my friends here who believe that these are just military problems that need to be solved rather than political problems. And my argument is don't go in if you don't know how you're going to get out and you don't know how you're going to solve the political and economic issues that are at the root.
I think a problem, though, Senator Murphy, is it suggests that we can somehow solve the political problem. You mentioned there a Shia government that treats Sunnis badly, causing some of the problems. Well, we can't foresee what the political outcome is going to be. We can't say, well, if we're going to work on the Iraq problem, we're going to make sure that it's a representative government that makes sure that both Sunnis and Shias and Kurds are all treated fairly. That's for those countries and those people, in some cases, those tribes to figure out. It sounds almost as though, as well-meaning as it is, that we're again presupposing that America can solve somebody's political problem before we even know what that problem might be.
Well, no, because I'm suggesting that if you don't have an answer to that question, right, and I think that in this case there might not be an answer, then there is no U.S. military solution, that the United States is going to have to stand back and do what we're doing today, which is to empower local players to solve the problems for themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what largely President Obama is doing today. He's saying he's not putting American military troops on the ground. You see what he's doing today with our Gulf state allies. He's standing those countries up. He's improving their military capacity. And that ultimately is likely the answer in this region. Now, there's always going to have to be room for targeted U.S. strikes when we think that there is an imminent threat to our national security. But if you don't have an answer for that, then the United States doesn't have a role in these places other than trying to support our local partners. Now, here's what I will say. The reason that the surge worked in 2007-2008, yes, it's because there were a lot of U.S. military troops there. But really why it worked is because we spent billions of dollars paying off Sunni tribal leaders to separate themselves from al-Qaeda in Iraq and align themselves with the government in Baghdad. That actually speaks ultimately to a solution. Now, I think there's probably a better way than handing over bags of cash to Sunni tribal leaders, but it answered their economic concern. They were able to help their people. Thus, they said, I don't have any more need for al-Qaeda in Iraq. It comes back to what I'm proposing at the outset of these principles. If you invest in economic support for these regions, you're going to get a lot further than if you simply support Tomahawk missiles designed to kill people in these regions. The surge worked in large part because we answered the economic needs of many Sunni tribes. And if we look at the root of that success, replicate it in a new way going forward, I think that is a solution that has a partial American face on it.
Chris Murphy and some of his colleagues in the Senate have mapped out 8 principles for foreign policy. We're talking with him about these principles and how they play in the world today, how they might rethink the way the U.S. engages with the rest of the globe. You can join us at 860-275-7266 as we continue our conversation with Senator Murphy, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, so-called Islamic State has been trafficking antiquities from Iraq and Syria and bankrolling its terrorism with this money. On the next Where We Live, we'll look at what's being done to protect thousands of cultural heritage sites from the threat of ISIS. We'll also look at how we protect our own cultural treasures here. Hope you can join us on the next Where We Live. Today, we're taking a look at foreign policy with Senator Chris Murphy, who joins us from Washington today. He and some colleagues have laid out 8 principles for foreign policy. They've been walking through, taking some of your tweets and emails at Where We Live. We've gotten through most of these, Senator Murphy, but I want to get to this something that you've mentioned before, and there's a lot of different things to talk about around reining in massive covert operations and intelligence apparatuses that have been emerging since 9/11, everything from mass surveillance to drone strikes. You say they steal moral authority from America. How do we turn around this boat?
We need another show and a half to tackle
this
one.
Yeah.
So I think there's I think there's moral implications to the way in which we've empowered our covert agencies, but also practical consequences. So the moral authority is simply this. When we're going out and telling the rest of the world that they need to pay attention to human rights and civil liberties, and then we are engaging in the mass gathering of data on our own citizens, you know, it makes other people listen a little bit less intently to what we're saying. And so I supported, for instance, a major reform of the Patriot Act, which passed the Congress last week, which isn't perfect, but it gets the U.S. government for the time being out of the business of collecting what's called metadata, all of the information about the cell phone calls that we make on a daily basis. But there are practical considerations to how big the CIA has gotten as well. The CIA is a major military operator overseas right now. Open source reporting will tell you what they've been doing. They were training the Syrian resistance for a long time before the Congress said that the Department of Defense should do that. They've been conducting drone strikes all over the Middle East for a very long time. And Congress has very little to say about that. There's a small group of members of the Intelligence Committee that watches their activities, but the rest of us really have no clue. And there are places in which it gets us into big trouble. For a long time in Pakistan, the CIA was conducting drone strikes against supposed Taliban and Al-Qaeda militants and weren't even telling our diplomats in Islamabad. And it was causing huge problems for the United States inside Islamabad. And there was no communication between the State Department and the CIA. One hand didn't know what the other hand was doing. The CIA was never intended to essentially be a shadow military. They were supposed to gather intelligence, do very limited operations. That's not what they do any longer. I think the Department of Defense should be conducting our military operations overseas. It should be done in the light of day so that the American public and Congress can see it. And the CIA ultimately is not responsible to the rest of us in the way the Department of Defense does, and they are not held accountable for the mistakes that they make.
And tied into this is your next principle, practicing what we preach on international human rights, get rid of secret detention centers, reject torture, things, again, that the CIA, this covert shadow military, has been engaged in for years.
And it just becomes bulletin board material for these extremist groups. When we continue to house people without trial, when we defend, as we did for nearly a decade, torture techniques that were banned by the Geneva Conventions, it allows for these groups to go out and recruit against us. Now, I'm never going to say that there is any justification for anyone joining a group like ISIS or Al-Qaeda or Boko Haram, but it shouldn't stop us from doing a little bit of self-evaluation and saying, are there things that we can do that will lead to less people hating the United States, less people organizing against us rather than more? It doesn't mean that we have to justify their existence or condone anyone joining some of these very terrible organizations. But when we, for a decade, essentially say it's okay to waterboard people, when we throw people into secret detention centers all around the world without any apology or self-introspection, it does cause more people to organize against us rather than less.
A lot of what you're talking about in these last two principles has to do with a lack of transparency and inability for whether it's the Congress or the rest of the American people to see exactly what is happening overseas. I think this ties into something I have to ask you about surrounding the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the deal that President Obama has been trying to get through Congress, which the House has rejected. One of the big problems that many Americans have with this is essentially it is a proposition that we are not allowed to take part in the conversation about. We don't know what's in the TPP, and so it's very hard for us to say we want our congresspeople to go and vote for it. Is this in some ways very much the same as some of the other things you're talking about, where as long as the United States conducts, whether it's foreign or domestic policy in secret, it's going to be very hard to bring other people along for the ride to join us in any sort of good fight?
I think there's an important distinction here. And, you know, I voted against the fast track bill that came before Congress. I'm generally a skeptic of TPP. But at least in the end, the United States Congress gets to look at the deal and we get to vote on it in an up or down manner. And I understand to a degree that when you're negotiating a really complicated document like a free trade agreement, that it can't happen in the light of day with C-SPAN cameras in the room, just like these complicated negotiations over Iran's nuclear program largely are going to have to happen behind closed doors. And then in the end, Congress will get to vote on it. I think there can be more transparency, but I don't want to create unrealistic expectations. What I'm talking about is American activity overseas that Congress never gets to see, never gets to vote on. When the CIA is covertly training rebels who are fighting inside Syria, I never actually get to look at the success or failure of that program. I never get to vote on whether I think it's a good or a bad idea. On the TPP, yeah, I would like to see more transparency, but I also acknowledge that on a complicated negotiation like that, we're not going to be in the room for the entirety of it. And so long as I get a vote in the end and my constituents for a period of weeks and months get to look at the document and decide up or down whether it's a good thing, you know, my problem on TPP is not necessarily transparency. It's more the content of the underlying document and whether it's good for Connecticut manufacturing.
And of course, the content of that document from both sides is really about strengthening or weakening of the American workforce. And that gets to the final principle we haven't talked about. Strength at home matters. You're right. We can't talk about economic empowerment here. If we can't have people rise up out of poverty, it's going to be awful hard to exert our authority around the world.
And so I think this is at the backbone of what causes a lot of people to say, listen, we just should get out of places like the Middle East and come back home. You know, people look around their neighborhood and say, listen, my friends and neighbors are hurting. You know, my commute to work has gotten longer, not shorter, over the past 20 years. I can't afford college. What are you doing spending all of this money in places like Egypt and Pakistan and Iraq? And so I didn't want to let us off the hook in terms of what we have to do domestically. We do have to improve our economy. We do have to address wage stagnation, income inequality. And that still has to be our first obligation, not just because that's what our constituents want us to do, but because, again, it allows us to lead. People are going to listen to us abroad because they look at us with envy, because they really do believe in the American dream. And if the American dream is fading, then our influence is fading as well. And so I do spend a lot of time on this question of America's role in the world because, you know, I've got two kids at home and I want them to grow up safe. I want them to grow up with an America that's leading in a way that makes them more safe. But I still spend the majority of my time on things like improving education and fighting for American manufacturing and fixing I-95 and Metro North, because that's not only what my constituents want me to spend the most time doing, but it also makes us stronger in the world if we're stronger at home.
We just have 2 minutes left, Senator Murphy. I have to ask you, you've endorsed Hillary Clinton, former Secretary of the State, for president. And obviously, she is running on her record in trying to talk about some of the things that she's voted for as a senator in the past, including voting for the Iraq War. If you laid out these eight principles of foreign policy to Senator and former Secretary Clinton right now, do you think that she would agree with them? Do you think that she essentially aligns with what you're talking about? We've got about a minute.
I think she does, and I wouldn't have endorsed her if I didn't think that she understands this new way in which America wants to lead. When she was Secretary of State, she actually created this concept of smart power, of economic statecraft. And so a lot of the ideas in this document come from her tenure as Secretary of State. Now, I disagree with her vote on the Iraq War, but even she admits that it was a mistake. And, you know, I hope that she and the folks on her foreign policy team will pay specific attention to this principle that talks about identifying political solutions overseas and not seeing every problem as a military problem. Yes, we have the best, most capable military in the world, but when you have a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And I think that's in part maybe what drove her to vote for the Iraq War, because she didn't understand the political complexities of the place and thought that the U.S. military could just solve the problem. I think she largely agrees with these principles, and I wouldn't support her if I didn't think that to be the case.
Chris Murphy is a U.S. Senator from Connecticut. He joined us today from Washington, D.C. Senator Murphy, always good to speak with you. Thanks for laying this out with us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, John.
Again, the piece for Foreign Affairs written with U.S. Senators Brian Schatz and Martin Heinrich is something that you can find on our website, WNPR.org/where we live, so you can continue the conversation there. Our program produced by Tucker Ives with Lydia Brown, Betsy Kaplan, and Kyone Wolf, along with Josh Nalea. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.